Hello, I'm Victoria Austin and you're listening to Shadow Talk. In this episode, we take on the indictment filed against a Russian national, Andrei Chuyrin, who between 2012 and 2015 allegedly participated in a global hacking campaign targeting major financial institutions, brokerage firms, news agencies and other companies. Although the hacking campaign took place between 2012 and 2015, the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York announced on the 24th of September 2019 that Andrei Chuyrin pled guilty in New York for the involvement in the massive network intrusions. So joining me today to discuss the developments around this indictment is Director of Security Engineering at Digital Shadows, Richard Gold. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Great. So I think we're going to kind of dive into the hacking crimes that took place in this time period, but we're going to kind of look at it from the perspective of the attacker. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the attacker goals, their TTPs, and map this against the MITRE pre-attack and attack framework. So kind of just look a bit more broadly, but I think it's worth kind of diving into the hacking campaigns. It's quite a broad term. So what did this kind of campaign entail?
So these guys were pretty interesting bunch, actually. So it's interesting to see the differences between what they've done versus some what we've seen with other cybercrime groups. The hacker in question also worked with somebody who was a customer of the companies that he was hacking. So not only did he have access to the information about these companies in a general sense, he also had access to credentials and login information to the services that were operated by these companies. So that enabled them to then look for weaknesses and vulnerabilities that would be present after the authentication, so post-auth, so they were able to actually get a much deeper read into the infrastructure of the targets rather than just relying purely on being on the outside. So I think that's one thing that's really worth noticing. It's kind of how your customers could also be malicious insiders, which is kind of a really unpleasant thought.
Okay. And when we kind of talk about they, it might be worth mentioning, I think it was three other individuals who was who were involved with this campaign. And I think one of them was that Chuyrin was working at the direction of an individual identified as Jerry Chalon. So this is quite a big cyber crime network, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a straight up organized criminal gang. It's an OCG. They worked together. They had other associates which are named and not named in the indictment. So it's a broad based thing. But I think certainly there was a hacking part of it and then a financial crimes part of it. And I think both of those two things are worth paying attention to in this indictment.
Okay. And so a bit more specifically, what were their kind of goals when they were performing this hacking campaign?
Right. So there were two main things that they were after. One thing was information about people. So they looked for sort of customer lists, all this kind of stuff, because their end goal, their ultimate end goal, was kind of disappointingly sending spam emails. And that's something which is quite funny, I think. So usually we associate network intrusions with, you know, espionage or maybe like the Fin7s of this world. But these guys were just interested in the customer data, keeping in mind again that this person who was the collaborator of Turing was also, you know, was a customer of all of these financial institutions. They were interested in the customer data of these financial institutions so that they could send them spam emails, specifically securities fraud. So to say, well, you know, it's a sort of pump and dump scheme. So you advertise that a stock is particularly hot or particularly undervalued. Then you've already bought a whole bunch of that stock at a cheap price. You use this pump and dump scheme to artificially inflate the price, and then you sell out and causes the stock to crash and, of course, to wipe out the other people who invested based on your fraudulent advice.
So, yeah, that's kind of a broad overview of what they were seeking to achieve. But I guess the next steps is to look at it from their perspective and identifying how they went about this. So maybe it's worth kind of diving into the techniques here.
Yeah, sure. It's also worth mentioning that once they were inside and sort of roaming around inside of other people's networks, They also looked for non-public information, which they thought would be useful to them in some way. And it was, again, from the indictment, is quite notable that they found emails, documents, and these kinds of things, but they were divided even amongst themselves about how best to use that internal information. So they had a clear path of how to use the customer data. You know, they would get the details, get the email addresses, send up the spam emails to drive the pump and dump schemes. That was very well established. But even though they found sensitive internal information, they lacked a clear path to monetize it. And they discussed amongst themselves the best way to do it. There were various chats going back and forth. You can read some of them in the indictment. And I think that's quite telling. Usually we think of that people are interested in this theft of non-public information straight off the bat. But it turns out that even though you can do it, it may simply not be worth your while unless you have a clear view about how to actually make money from it. Otherwise, you end up with a whole load of documents and PowerPoint and spreadsheets and no way to actually do anything with it. So in terms of the actual techniques themselves, as I mentioned, they had access to the internal sort of web-facing infrastructure of various services because they were customers, or one of the members was a customer of so many institutions. And I think the one that jumped out to me from the indictment is that they actually used Heartbleed. So there was a lot of, you know, rage and weeping and wailing of gnashing of teeth when Heartbleed hit the internet back in 2014. And there was a lot of debate of, you know, would it be used? Could it be used? Could it not be used? There was the Cloudflare challenge. There were people saying that, you know, it wasn't useful outside of the lab. And as per usual, attackers didn't care about all of that chat, got straight down to work, and they used it operationally. There was also a hospital that was mentioned in a Reuters article that where Heartbleed was the method of initial access in that particular case as well. So I think it was pretty notable that these guys started to use it as well. So they clearly found an operational use for it. Although it says that they also lost access, so it seems that somebody actually patched their servers and then for some reason, whatever technique they were using to gain access got locked out. And just to remind people, if they've forgotten the heady days of 2014, Heartbleed was the ability to leak internal memory out of a server that was running a vulnerable version of an SSL library, OpenSSL.
So once they gained access, what did they then do?
So they dropped a web shell on the web servers that they had compromised. And again, the indictment gives some juicy hints, but again, it's not a how-to. So there's usually pieces missing. So we're kind of filling in the blanks here, but we're assuming then that they used Heartbleed to somehow compromise a web server that was running this vulnerable version of OpenSSL. Then they used a web shell, so a small program which they embed in the code of the web server, which gives them the ability to regain access whenever they feel like it, and also gives them the ability to execute commands on that web server. So it's a very handy technique to use when you've compromised a web server. Whilst it's most likely the attackers used a web shell to gain persistence once they'd exploited these publicly facing services, it could have been something else that they used as well. Again, the indictment's not completely clear. It could have been an SSH backdoor or some kind of rat, but a web shell seems like the most likely candidate. And once they'd established this foothold, they then decided to move through the networks that they'd compromised, looking for the information they were after, specifically this customer data, as I mentioned. And I think it's quite interesting to note, it's an almost poetic turn of phrase that they used. So they said, and I'm quoting from the indictment here, traversing victim one's network infrastructure in search of his customer database was like, quote, opening a book in the middle to look for a sentence not knowing exactly where to start. Which I think is, yeah, a lovely phrase. So, you know, maybe they can, during their time in the clink, they can spend some time working on their poetry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was, again, security through, you know, scale. Just having a massive network meant it was very difficult for them to find the information they were looking for. They clearly had to work really hard to get it, and that gives you detection opportunities to look for somebody who's doing a lot of searching around your network, around your databases. So that I think is quite an interesting little nugget from the indictment. They also were using sort of rented infrastructure for their C2, sort of pretty standard stuff. And once they got burned, so somebody figured out what was going on and started to block their IP, and I guess the IP made it into a block list. The attackers actually read the media reports around the intrusions that they made themselves. Once they saw that they'd been burned, then they cancelled the rental of this particular C2 service, which was quite interesting. I mean, you know, attackers read the news too, yeah, right?
So it's very reactive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's like threat intelligence for beginners is, you know, just reading the press. So they clearly were paying attention to what was going on and sensitive to that as well, which is also interesting. And they pulled then, once they gained this final access to the customer database, in one case they were pulling, you know, 85 million customer records from the database to use for the security fraud that they did, these pump and dump schemes. That's a lot of data.
Mm. So what kind of gave it away for them then in this process?
So I think the securities fraud itself was something that was quite noticeable. I mean, the US authorities are pretty hot on that kind of thing. It's not something that they're desperately happy about people getting away with. It seemed as well that they were creating a lot of noise with these intrusions. They were going into a lot of places, and again, that they were using customer accounts to do that reconnaissance work. So once they got in, using legitimate credentials, then exploring the web servers that were behind the services that they'd gotten into. It's an interesting combination when you have hackers and then sort of fraudsters working together in this way. I think that's kind of something we've alluded to before in the podcast we did on high-frequency trading and the sort of cyber risks around high-frequency trading, that when you get hackers and financial nerds working together, you know, you can expect to see this kind of thing. And it was, as I say, it's almost kind of tawdry and disappointing that they used all of this access for a simple kind of pump and dump spam campaign. And they were clearly just completely at loss about how to monetize the access that they had. So that even though they had the ability to hack into, you know, some pretty major places, if you look at the media reports, they didn't really understand what they had. They didn't really understand what they found. And, you know, they had that one very, very simple play, which was pull everybody's customer data and then send them all these spam emails. And of course, if you're doing it at the scale of millions of people potentially, then yeah, eventually you'll get lucky. And they made a lot of money as well.
Do you think though that their lack of knowledge of what they were trying to do kind of hints that someone else was telling them what to do?
It's a good question. I don't know. I think in some cases they're just empiricists. They figure out what works, and then once they get a trick that works for them, like they make a bit of money out of it, then they just go to town on it and just keep on hitting that again and again and again until their luck runs out. I think making good money out of stolen information when you don't have an explicit customer in mind is challenging. And I mean, when we've looked a long time ago at the Sue Bin indictment, this guy who got busted for going into Boeing, and that indictment is also fascinating reading precisely because it has all of the negotiations with the hacking crew who are operating as freelancers and this sort of state-owned enterprise, SOE1, or I think it's called in the indictment, with, you know, the information that they had. And the hackers were complaining the whole time that, you know, they weren't getting the money that they wanted, and that, you know, this customer that they had wasn't really that interested, and, you know, they stole, you know, 65 gig whatever of information out of Boeing, and then nobody really knows what to do with it. And I've heard this as well from people who've done nation state offensive cyber operations, that getting in is easy, but actually once you've pulled out all of this information, how do you make sense of it? And imagine it's in a foreign language to you. Then do you have, you know, in this case, like with Boeing, you've got 65 gigabytes of documents. Are you going to translate that into something else? I mean, how does that all fit together, that whole piece around processing the information that you've stolen? And so in that sense, it actually kind of, I kind of see why the attackers did what they did, because they had a very simple path for monetizing that access and, you know, trying to make sense of, I don't know, some Q4 budget report. It's just too much work.
So, yeah, I guess another element that we have that is worth considering when you're thinking about the cybercrime gang is once they've made money, they then have to launder it or hide the fact that they have this money. So I think that's quite interesting, because they also set up schemes to try and filter this money out or hide traces of it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's also a really important point for all of these things, is that one thing is to actually get hold of the money, and then the other thing is to actually keep it and or make it into something which is actually useful. So cash out, I suppose, to monetize that access. So then again, these securities fraud schemes where you are kind of, you know, you have a built-in way to make money from what you've got. You know, you've taken your position, and then you've unfairly influenced other people to take their position, and then you benefit when it all crashes. That's a very straightforward way, and it's to make money, and you can see how that happens. Whereas if you've got, even if, and we've seen that also with like FinCEN, you know, they were selling the credit cards that they stole on Joker Stash, you know, they lacked a way to directly monetize the access that they had. They were relying on a third party for that. Or say in the Boeing case, they were trying to sell the information that they stole. And I think as well, if to make sense of these operations and to also think about how to protect against them, to understand how people cash out, I think is also really important. And I think that's what's kind of fun with this one, is it was almost a surprising way to cash out. I wouldn't have expected people who had access to so much to take that way, to take that route to cash out versus, yeah, I don't know, actually, to, you know, selling the stolen information to someone who might find it useful.
Selling on. Yeah, so I guess it's probably worth identifying how they cashed out. So they used unlawful internet gambling businesses. They owned and operated multinational payment processors for illegal pharmaceutical suppliers, counterfeit and malicious software distributors, and unlawful internet casinos. So all of those schemes in general were used to try and launder the funds, I guess.
Yeah. And that's really interesting that you mentioned that, because it really shows the scale of the operation, that it really was not just like a one-man band, but it really was like all these different things together that they were up to. And I think the illegal payment processor one is particularly interesting, as they would take payments for things where other legitimate companies wouldn't have accepted the payment. And then they put these fraudulent payments through the whole payment processing network. So they gave people an in into this legitimate world through operating it fraudulently and not doing any verification, or deliberately, you know, not doing any verification about where the payments came from in the first place.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of like a broad overview of this scintillating story. It's been quite interesting to track. It's definitely worth reading the indictment. But I guess when you're thinking about what we can learn from this, what do you kind of recommend as a few tips?
I think the first thing is, obviously, in terms of initial access, that, you know, when these big vulnerabilities hit, which can be used for initial access, you can expect them to be used with reckless abandon against any organization that's vulnerable. We've seen that even just very recently with the whole SSL VPN vulns that were disclosed at Black Hat, that they've immediately been picked up and being used pretty aggressively. And it was the same with Heartbleed back in 2014. So once that hit, as soon as there was, you know, some very simple POCs that were available, people were all over it. So you can expect that to happen. So I think in terms of initial access, that's certainly something which I took away from this. And I think the other thing is to think about, how can people make money legitimately from the data that you hold, because that will then show you what people will be likely to be targeting when they're coming after you, so that it gives you a better sense about what to protect. And that, I think, is crucial to being able to prioritize effectively, to know what are my assets and what are the threats to those assets.
Definitely. I totally agree with that one. So, yeah, as we've discussed, Rich has published a very, very interesting blog on resources.digitalshadows.com. So if you're interested in learning a bit more, definitely worth a read. So yeah, thank you very much for listening.
Cool.